Welcome again to another edition of Jedi and Germs, a weekly podcast brought to you by the Torn by Sports Podcast Network and blogtalkradio.com. I'm Alan Zog, the Jedi. He's John English, the Germs guy. Hello, John.
Hello, Alan.
Hello, Devin.
Hello, Alan.
Wow. It almost sounded like an echo between the two. Anyway, yeah, whatever. How are you guys today?
I'm pretty good. Pretty good.
And I'm pretty good.
Oh, my word. Let's quit with the echo responses. I'm doing really good. And you know why I'm doing really good? We'll talk about this in a minute. But, you know, the Jazz are doing really well right now, and so is Gordon Hayward. And I'm kind of excited to talk about it tonight because there's a lot of cool stuff. But we've got a great show ahead of us. You know, Jazz, Super Bowl, we will talk that. LeBron James, we got quite a bit to talk about on this show. I'm going to change it up just a little bit before we start. We always wait till the end. Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell our listeners who are just joining us, take a minute, leave a review on iTunes. We appreciate it. Leave us a review. I know it can be annoying and problematic, but that review goes a long ways for us. So if you head out to iTunes, look up Jedi and Germs, leave us a review. If you enjoy this episode and any of the other shows that you've gotten a chance to join us for, we'd appreciate it greatly. That is iTunes. You can find us at Jedi and Germs. Wanted to get that out of the way before we start, because you know what? Really grateful for all our listeners and everybody that joins us. And we want to be able to hear from you. So, all right, let's start with this week's show. Let's start with last night's win, shall we?
Yeah, 25-point win on the road against a playoff team. Awesome to watch from beginning to end. Even when it looked like they were going to let Atlanta back in the game, I think they're only up 4 at halftime.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
And then second half, they just. You know, put the foot on the throat and didn't let up. And very encouraging play from so many players. You know, Dante Exum's looking more and more comfortable every game. Gordon Hayward has been averaging 26 points a game this entire week. You know, Gobert has been dominant on defense. Favors had a 20-10 game.
Favors hit some 3-pointers last night. At least one.
Yeah, Favors is doing stuff he hasn't done much. it was exciting.
It was
nice to see this team. They looked like a home court advantage playoff team.
Well, and I'd expect you to do your homework on this one too, but I think I'm pretty close to being right. I believe the Jazz had a season high in assists last night too.
I hadn't looked that up, but that does sound right. They had 31 assists.
Yes, which they did.
Jazz don't usually get 31 assists a game. You have to go back to Darren Williams for the Jazz team to be like that. So,
and there were so many unselfish plays last night too. I mean, you could go even the plays that didn't turn into points. I mean, the between the legs pass from Rudy to a cutting George Hill to, you know where he turns around and passes to a Boris Diaw who drops it over his shoulders to, you know, to George Hill in the corner for a wide open three and he misses. But it's just over and over again throughout the game last night, there were plays like that where there were sequences like that where it was pass after pass after pass. Nobody cared who took the shot. It was just until you got the right shot, you passed the ball. And it was so beautiful to watch. So amazing, so sensational. And then, you know, you mentioned Gordon Hayward. There were moments last night where Gordon just took over. You know, we haven't seen Gordon take over. And last night he did that at some points, didn't he?
I'd say we've seen it, but last night was one of the ones where it just looked so effortless for him. Where when he decided he wanted to score, he scored. And that's all there was to it. And Atlanta couldn't stop him.
And, you know, the fact that he has improved his physique over the summer, you know, through workouts and stuff, I know everybody talks about his workouts and that he comes built. It's moments that you watch in the game last night where he's able to finish with the contact. and finish in such a way that that really skinny Gordon Hayward from 3 or 4 years ago wouldn't have been able to do. And he just goes in the paint and finishes with contact. It's really fun to watch Gordon progress as a player, and he's doing it right in the middle of the season too.
Yeah, it was his sixth game this year where he scored at least 30 points. He was 12 of 18 from the floor. I mean, who was the main defender? Was it Bazemore they usually had on him? It just didn't seem to matter.
Yeah, it was Bazemore for a bit there, and then I'm trying to think who else they went. I think Bazemore was it most of the time. But yeah, I mean, and just Gordon's line, I'm looking at it. 30 points, like you said, 12 of 18. He was 4 of 5 from the free throw line, so he didn't go as much to the free throw line. But he was 2 of 5 from downtown, 7 rebounds, 5 assists, 2 steals, and only 2 turnovers, by the way. It's a pretty good line.
Yep. So they are now, due to this awesome week, they are on pace for a 52-win season. It'll be cool if they can keep that up. Looking ahead, they've got a couple road games. At the Pelicans, they should win. At Dallas, they should win, although Dallas has been playing well as of late. And then they have two road games or two home games against Boston and the Clippers.
Both of which Clippers are going to be difficult.
Well, Chris Paul will still be out for the Clippers game, so they really should win that one. The Boston game is going to be their biggest challenge. When they played at Boston, Isaiah Thomas lit them up, and I would hope that the Jazz players are looking for some revenge by the time that game gets here.
Yeah. Well, the other guy that I thought was key in that game in Boston was Crowder. I don't know that you can expect Crowder to, unless the media gives him more bulletin material. I don't think bulletin board material. I don't think Crowder's going to come in and be the kind of player he was in Boston either. Right?
Yeah.
Well, I think he'll be pretty pumped up.
Why? Because he's in front of the Utah crowd this time?
Yeah, yeah. I think the Jazz fans, if you're going to the game, please cheer for Jay Crowder during any introductions. We really want him to feel comfortable, and after that whole fiasco last time, I only think it's fair. Gordon will understand. He's an all-star. You can cheer for him too, but let's give Jay a little love.
Wow. You going for a little reverse psychology here? Is that what it is?
Yeah, no. He's my man, you know, JC.
Wow. John, do you have anything to add to this before Devin just runs away with it?
It tweaked out on me. I couldn't hear everything he was saying.
That's probably a good thing. The listeners will probably wish that as well. Let's get back to
put it in a nutshell. Devin said that all the crowd in Salt Lake on Saturday needs to cheer for Jay Crowder.
Excellent.
A little reverse psychology, but also show him the love from Salt Lake. Gordon will understand.
That will be interesting.
Yeah, no kidding.
I wonder if they're going to give Crowder some heavy noise.
I don't know.
I don't think fans really care.
I hope the fan base is on point enough to like sarcastically cheer Crowder when he's introduced.
I would laugh at that. It's the blue-out game, though.
If I happen to go to that game, I will cheer Jay Crowder when he's introduced.
I think I will too, just for the fun of it.
We need to make this happen.
That's the power of Twitter.
And by the way, it is the blue out game. So you're listening, you've already seen it from the Jazz. Wear your blue. It's the blue out game. It's gonna be fun. So I noticed in our show notes you actually were comparing with Houston as well. You know, you were comparing the next few games with Houston. You and I spoke briefly in message over Twitter. The Jazz, Houston, and the Clippers over the next 9-10 games, it'll be an interesting situation. Houston has the easiest road to remain at number 3, but you're looking at the next 3 or 4 games. Where are we at for Houston?
Well, Houston won tonight, so they're now 3.5 games ahead. They beat Orlando at home. They have a road game against Charlotte. And Charlotte, Jazz were able to win, but who knows? It's a road game. And then they have two home games against Phoenix and Miami. Phoenix, they'll probably beat by 30. Miami normally would have been a gimme, except Miami has been playing really well as of late. So
they're
that one could
hot.
Actually be a that could be one they lose. So we could catch up to them there. But I would just say, looking, you know, 10 games down the road, I don't see the Jazz catching up to Houston anytime soon. I think once we get to like March, the schedules will even out to where I think they could catch them, but it'll be tough.
Well, and over the next 10 games, the one game that is key for the Jazz with regards to Houston is when they meet each other. Jazz really need to win that game. That will help in the case of a tiebreaker, but that needs to happen. They need to win the season series in that game. Granted, it's on the road, but it needs to happen. So that's your next four or five games. Miami, you mentioned, has been hot. Last time I checked, 9 in a row, but I don't know if they've won one since then. I don't remember.
I will have that in a second.
Okay. Well, while you're looking that up, so yeah,
they have won 11 in a row.
Oh, 11 in a row. Dang.
They have won 11 in a row, and yet they are 22-30. That is how bad they started the season.
Yeah.
But they can now say they are two games out of the eighth seed.
Yeah, that's which might be very intriguing even more for that Charlotte matchup for Houston as well, because I believe Charlotte's fighting for one of those last
Charlotte's
spots.
Tied for eighth. Yeah. So.
So that could be an interesting matchup for the Rockets. All right, let's shift gears. You did mention briefly Dante Exum. He's been playing extremely well. Last night was a great game. I thought he played well against Milwaukee, too, if I remember correctly. Or not Milwaukee, yeah. Charlotte. Charlotte.
Well, yeah, he had been some DMPs for a while, and then it was the Milwaukee game where he got back in. And he would only get 1 or 2 minute spurts. And Dan Clayton had this great breakdown of how Dante missed two defensive assignments in back-to-back possessions, and that's why he was sitting. And I think Dante really took that to heart, because when you look at how he's played the last two games, he looked like he's getting back to form, playing with confidence. There was one span. Was it in last night's game or was it against Charlotte where he scored? No, it was the Charlotte game where he scored 8 points straight for the team when he came in, and you know, crowd was excited, and he would have had 14 points, but they reviewed as a 3-pointer that actually he didn't quite get off in time. But he was a big part of the win against Charlotte. Atlanta wasn't as big a part. He wasn't in the game when they had their big run, but it seems like he is doing a better job of absorbing what he needs to do, learning from it, and benefiting the team while he's out there. And I'm very encouraged by what we've seen lately. People will recall his rookie year, he hardly got any time, and then suddenly halfway through the season he was starting, and we just saw him blossom into this amazing defensive player. And I think we're going to see something similar in the second half of this season, where we're going to see Dante blossom. He's better on offense than he was. His defense isn't quite what it was at the end of his rookie year, but as long as he has that confidence, I think we'll see that improvement continue.
Well, and if we've seen right by most of, I mean, Quinn seems to really encourage the defense, and if guys are not performing well enough on defense, he makes a change. No player seems exceptioned from that. I mean, look at the other night against Charlotte, where, you know, Kaminsky was just torching the Jazz, and I was at the game. I don't know whether they showed this on TV, but at the first timeout, you saw Quinn look at Rudy as he coming off, and he laid into him. And Rudy came off, sat on the bench for a bit. They went back to him, and Kaminsky continued right after the timeout. And I'm my memory may not serve me well on this, but the next time he pulled Rudy
that's probably right. Rudy had a rough game,
yeah,
for parts of that.
And
because Jazz won by 7, but Rudy was 0 actually.
And I did watch that matchup, and Kaminsky scored 10 straight. very early on for you know, in the game. And Quinn laid into Rudy a second time as he pulled him out of the game. And he put Derek on Kaminsky. Kaminsky didn't score again. In fact, Kaminsky took a break and then, but didn't score again in the second quarter. I think he scored 2 points, but really was ineffective. And it seemed to me that Quinn was content to stay away from that matchup, Rudy versus Kaminsky. But after Kaminsky went cold there in the second quarter, really didn't play a lot, come out in the third quarter, he went back to him against Rudy, and I don't think he was ever effective again. But for a while there, I think, you know, it's just, to me, that's what I'm watching with Quinn. Quinn's pulling guys if they're not, if the defense isn't working for him. And I think he's going to do the same for Exum. I just think Exum's looking better right now.
Well, Exum's looking better, and you're seeing that with Trey Lyles.
Yeah, you are.
Trey Lyles goes, I mean, you saw that in the Atlanta game. I think Trey Lyles' first stint, he was only in there like 3 minutes. He came in, missed a shot, missed a defensive assignment on the other end.
Yep.
Missed another shot, missed another defensive assignment, and that was that. And then Lyles was back out of the game.
The identity of the team is defense. If you're not able to play, not willing is not the word I'm looking for, because I think all these guys are willing. But if it's not working, Quinn's going to yank you. And he's going to go with somebody that he hopes will be a little more effective in that matchup. And you're seeing that. And that's what I think Exum is going to have to deal with. And to get extended time on the floor, he's going to have to continue to be aggressive on defense. Yes, no?
Yeah.
Are we in agreement there?
Yes.
I think so, yeah.
I would agree.
So, all right. Let's move on then to... What do we have next? We have our NBA rapid fire. Let's move to NBA. Go ahead, John.
Okay. Frank Isola of the New York Media Circle had wrote an article saying that LeBron James wanted to trade Kevin Love for Carmelo Anthony. LeBron came out, called it trash. He called Frank Isola trash. Frank obviously had his feelings hurt because he tweeted out, this might hurt his chances for getting SI Sportsman of the Year. To which I say, get over yourself, Frank. But Frank's source doesn't necessarily mean Frank wrote anything false. It's just that you have to wonder who his source was. Is it someone from another team who's trying to make this happen? Maybe someone from New York. It also doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't anyone in the Cavs office who was having serious talks with New York on what they would willing to do in order to make a Carmelo Anthony trade happen. I like that LeBron stuck up for his teammate, and I would be shocked if LeBron was honestly behind any talks, if they're happening at all, to have Kevin Love shipped out of Cleveland, since LeBron did not win his ring in Cleveland until he had Kevin Love. So,
yeah, I agree. I went out and read an interesting bit on CBS Sports about it too. You know, what first thing that comes to mind here is nobody in the media is exempt. I think everybody here in Utah remembers not long ago, Hoop Critic, and I forget his name, Hoops Critic, talked about a source that indicated that the Jazz were shopping Gordon Hayward to Boston, and there was talks. And I don't know if you remember that. I think it was just towards the end of last year, was it?
I remember that. But
and then
yeah,
let's not mix that up with the guy who's actually a professional.
Okay, but
reporter.
Yeah,
here.
I get it. I agree. But hold off for a second, because that guy was actually stuck by a story. Now, Frank Isola, I like Frank, and usually he's pretty good about his reporting. So you're right. Totally different apples and oranges, but yet the scenario is fairly similar in this case. Frank, though, like you said, probably got maybe either a bad source or a good source for that matter. It, interestingly enough, the CBS report, Frank went on Sirius XM and said maybe it was the timing that was just bad for LeBron, because I stand by my story, but it was presented to him in a really bad way. And this particular article I read is very funny, too, because Frank turns around and puts it on the New York Post instead of the New York Times, whatever it was. Really, he seems to have a beef with the other paper up there. But it was very interesting to read that Frank, you know, said, hey, it could have been timing more than anything. My source is right. What I've heard is right. But they presented it to him following a loss, probably not the best, or following a win, whatever it was, probably not the best time to present it to him. Yes or no? Do you agree?
Well, I want to say this. That other guy you brought up, I blocked because he's just a useless internet troll. Frank Isola is a real reporter.
Yes, this is true.
I had to look up where he works. It's the New York Daily News. That's who he works for.
Thank you.
I mainly know him from ESPN's Around the Horn.
Yes.
I'm not, unlike that other guy, Frank's not a guy who's going to make something up. I just question who his source was and what their motive was. In fact, I just looked at Frank's Twitter feed and his last tweet was, I don't know if he wrote this or he's just linking to his paper, but it's saying, James Dolan must stop Phil Jackson's bullying of Carmelo Anthony because Phil took another Twitter swipe at Carmelo. Phil Jackson is doing everything he can to get Carmelo out of there. And, you know, it's kind of like around this time last year, things weren't working for the Knicks, so he fired his head coach. This year, things aren't working out so well, so now he's trying to fire his head player. I just, you know, as an outsider looking in, I just don't think this Phil Jackson thing is working out in New York. And New York would probably be better off moving on from Phil.
I wonder.
Having said that, there's probably got to be a lot of interesting offers they would get for Carmelo. And I do think Carmelo would be better off going somewhere else.
I wonder if Isola's connection is with the New York Knicks, maybe, and that's where he's hearing it from, because it's a bunch of smoke and mirrors coming from Phil Jackson. Maybe.
Maybe.
I mean, something to be said of that. It's just interesting to me. I read his comments from Sirius, and it's just very interesting. You know, I like I said, I like Frank. And I think Frank's been on the big show a few times with Spence here locally. And, I mean, he's a well-respected guy.
Frank loves to needle Spence whenever he's on.
I know he does.
And vice versa.
they have a good relationship. So, but I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, do I think that Carmelo will end up in Cleveland? No. I think you and I would agree on that, wouldn't we?
Yes. Yeah. Cleveland is not going to move Kevin Love unless someone offers them something undeniable, and I can't think of what that would be.
No, I agree. Devin, you have a weird look. You have thoughts on this?
This is supposed to be a quick hit.
Rapid fire.
Yeah, it's supposed to be rapid.
So we're done.
It was a trash report.
We're done.
It's not going to happen. It just, bad source. No, you don't move Kevin Love. It would be stupid to do so. And we saw that with the game at Washington.
Yes, we did, with a football pass the length of the floor to 3-point bank shot to tie it up and send it to overtime. Yes, we did.
Is that on our rapid fire list? Can we transition to that? Because I want to talk about that.
We'll go to that in a minute, because the next rapid fire topic has to do with the draft.
Okay. I wanted to bring up the draft because Chad Ford is starting to do his mock drafts, and this is the first time in a long time that we probably don't care that much about the draft, but they do have two late first round picks, and it is interesting to see who is hovering around there, especially those people who are fans of college basketball and, you know, can take an interest in what guys might be around. When you get into late first round, you get a lot of Euro stashes, and Chad, in fact, does have two Euro projects going to the Jazz. At number 23, he has this 18-year-old power forward named Isaiah Hartenstein. He's from Germany. And his notes on him is, while he might be the least ready of the fours we're ranking, there's a high ceiling with him. There aren't many seven-footers with his combination of athleticism, elite skill level, and motor. Okay, that's interesting. And then for number 30, he has a Belgian player who's a shooting guard that apparently needs to work on his outside shot. But, you know, at number 30, maybe that's what's around and they want to do that. Jazz are having enough success where they could afford to take some risks, maybe get some stashes. That would be something they're looking at. Other players that are in the NCAA right now that they might be interested in. For those who watch Texas, they have a guard named Andrew Jones that is probably going to be in the 20s. And I would also be looking at Gonzaga. Their center, Zach Collins, is probably going to be around that area as well.
All right. You know, I'm not anywhere near the draft, so you're the expert on this show when it comes to the draft. So trust your judgment on it.
Jazz have two firsts and two seconds, and it's one of those where their seconds are probably going to go the way of their seconds last year, where we had, yes, we got Joel Bolenboy, and the other 2 seconds just kind of might as well have not had them.
Right. Okay. All right. That's NBA. Well, no, Devin. Yes. One more topic on NBA rapid fire. You want to talk about that pass play shot from LeBron and Kevin Love last night. Do you not?
I wanted to, but the moment's passed.
No, no, it's not.
It was a really cool pass, an 80-foot pass on the money.
Yep.
With the last second spinning three. Just one of the best endings to regulation that you could hope for.
My question to ask, Devin, I'll ask you first. Did he call bank or no?
Man, I wanted to say he called game, but he didn't call game. He called overtime.
Did he call bank or no, though?
He said overtime.
Right, but did he say bank or no on that shot? Because I mean...
Are you questioning the king?
John, did he say bank or no?
No.
No? Okay. Just throw it up there and hope it goes in? Is that what we're deciding?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah, I was watching the multiple angle coverage from ESPN earlier today. And it's great because not only do they show you the angles of the shot, but as the shot's going in, they zoom in on all the player expressions on the Wizards bench.
Mm. And the one coach that decides to just sit down, it's like, yep, time to go back to work.
That was a special play.
Yes, it was.
So, you know, it's funny that we talk about Love getting traded when you see things like that, because Kevin Love is known for throwing those long outlet passes like that.
Yes, he is.
And he and LeBron seem to have a connection in that way, kind of reminiscent of what you saw in Miami with Bron and Wade, I think. Am I off base with that?
I don't know that the relationship's quite the same level, but yes, I see where you're going.
I'm not saying like, you know,
best friends.
Yeah, they're right. The best of friends. But with Love, there is a connection there where they seem to know where the other's going to be when they need a quick out.
Agreed. John?
Yeah, there was a lot of reports that maybe their chemistry wasn't great last year. They're not good friends. And when you think about it, the guys on your team, they're basically your coworkers. And when you think about your own jobs and your coworkers, you don't have to be best friends with all your coworkers, but there are some coworkers that you just enjoy at work and you get along well with at work. And I think LeBron and Kevin are kind of like that.
Yeah.
I think it's a lot better this year because championship rings just tend to heighten your warm fuzzies for your fellow coworkers that much more.
Absolutely. Especially.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, especially when your coworker is putting up 20 points a night throughout the finals anyway.
Yeah.
Well, it's like the queen says, if you like it, then you should have put a ring on it.
Oh.
And LeBron and Love put rings on it.
All right. We just went downhill.
It's not wrong.
No, it's not. I'm just kidding. All right. Let's shift gears, and we're going to go ahead and talk listener questions. We have a couple of listener questions this week. John, I want to start with the basketball one first. We had one over Twitter, but I want to start with the one in the message. We were asked by Brett, one of our listeners, Brett, who wanted to know, we all are in agreement that LeBron's the best all-around player, right?
Yes.
Okay. You know, he kind of put that like best shooter, best defender, LeBron's best all-around player. You have your best shooter, best defender. But he wants to know where Gordon Hayward fits in the discussion of best all-around player. What do we think?
Where do we put him? Well, he's about where you'd put him on NBA rank. Let's try to think of best all-around players better than him. And by that, I mean offensive and defensive. You know,
two-way players, right? Yeah, two-way players.
Yes.
Yes.
LeBron's a two-way player. Durant's a two-way player. Kawhi's a two-way player. You know, and then there are other players who are better than Gordon, but, you know, Harden's not much on defense. So do we say he's not a better all-around player because he's so good on offense that can you really say that?
Right. No.
I mean, how are we doing this, you know?
I think you have to look at the net. You know, you have to look at what you're getting from both sides and kind of average them out. You know, Hayward is going to have higher averages on both sides of the ball, but I don't think that his offense is, or his defense for that matter, is going to help him catch Harden. You know, at the end of the day, as much as it pains me to say it, we're talking about,
I mean, if
MVP
you go by real
candidate.
Plus minus, yeah, if you go by real plus minus, he's number 32. And that, you know, that looks at your offensive and defensive. Harden is ninth. And his defense is lower than Hayward's, but his offense is so much better that that's where he winds up falling.
Right. No, I agree. I mean, that's where that discussion's difficult to make. I mean, if you really want to break it down favorably for Hayward, you almost have to talk position-wise. And he's legitimately the fourth, maybe fifth best small forward in the NBA. That's where you have to go, isn't it?
Yeah. If you look at small forwards, you got LeBron James, Kevin Durant, Kawhi Leonard. And then you go, well, you got Greek Freak, you got Jimmy Butler. And Hayward's right there, you know?
See, I almost think that Butler is just a hair above Hayward. And I really think that Hayward is above Giannis at this point.
So do I.
Yeah.
You know, so when we're looking at position, that's probably about where he falls in my mind.
The real question here comes in how much it, you know, not so much how much they contribute to their team, maybe, but how much they carry. I think Gordon's asked to do a lot more for his team than, say, Butler or Giannis, isn't he? Butler's better, but can the Bulls, they rely on a different aspects
Butler,
of his game.
All these guys are the main player on their team.
Right.
And yeah, Butler and Giannis are asked to do as much as Hayward is asked to do. Jazz are just more successful right now.
Right. No, it's an interesting discussion. Brett, I mean, thanks, Brett, for posing it, because I think it's something that we could spend a long episode talking about. But I think for this short segment, I think that covers it. Let's go to our next question.
The next one was snow nuts. What's the deal? There's actually debate on how grape nuts got its name. Some believe that because it was used glucose to sweeten it, glucose was sometimes called grape sugar. And they thought that might be where it came from. It is also made from wheat and barley. And when you combine those two, that has a nutty flavor. There's also, I read one thing that said that employees at Post compared the look of their cereal to grape seeds. And so they would just call it grape nuts. But there is no concrete definitive reason why grape nuts ultimately was how it came to be known.
Interesting question. I've always posed that myself, actually. I enjoy a good bowl of grape nuts, and I've always wondered why they're called that. So he also responded to you with, you mentioned you're pretty sure it was a Seinfeld episode, right? Yes.
It was part of Jerry Seinfeld's routine, yes.
Okay.
No grapes, no nuts. What's the deal?
Yes. And then he mentioned Linda Richman posed the topic of conversation.
Yes.
Who's Linda Richman?
Linda Richman from Coffee Talk. She was on Saturday Night Live. She would get verklempt, and she would give people discussion topics. The Holy Roman Empire was neither holy nor Roman nor an empire. Discuss.
All right. Well, that answers that. So yeah, thanks, Sam, for that topic of discussion, grape nuts. Looks like we got a late bloomer in the questions, right?
Oh, we do?
Yeah. Did you see the late one? You favored it.
Oh, John Wick versus John McClane. I would say John Wick, and I say that because while I really loved John McClane initially, the more we see of McClane, the less I like him, and that's unfortunate. John Wick 2 opens this weekend, and its Rotten Tomato rankings right now is 95%. So I will go with John Wick just because right now he is awesome and he has not gone to Russia for a really crappy sequel so far.
All right. Thanks to Jared for that question. So, any other questions I'm missing?
No. I think we covered it all.
All right. Well, let's jump into Devin's quick hits.
All right. DeMarcus Cousins ejected for shoving an assistant coach against the Bulls, I believe.
Yes.
Yep.
In fact, he was beloved Jim Boylan.
Is he ever going to get it together? That's my question. Or is this just his career always going to have this?
He will never get it together in Sacramento.
Ooh, you put in Sacramento on that.
I hope that if he goes to a new environment that he could. But I think as long as he's in Sacramento, no.
Interesting you say that because all the talks recently about trades and everything, and then Vlade Divac comes out with a statement earlier this week and says, we're not trading DeMarcus Cousins.
I think that's a negotiating tactic, or Vlade is still just not getting it. There was an amazing, I think it was on Locke's podcast, where he talked about a DeMarcus Cousins story where Ty Corbin, when he was Kings coach, was going over film and showing them all their mistakes.
Yep.
And Cousins stood up and said, what about your mistakes? What about, let's watch film about your coaching mistakes. And it was just amazing to me that any player would do that to any coach. Well, and that just seems indicative of how DeMarcus is allowed to just be a big baby over there and get away with it because he's so talented.
Well, and interestingly enough, that same story surfaced in a recent article on ESPN. If you haven't read it, John, I'll link it to you. You need to read it. It's long.
Okay.
But it is the subject of, is the problem Sacramento or is the problem DeMarcus? And I don't remember who wrote it. It's killing me. But it was an interesting piece that was one of the scenarios brought up. But it also brought up, who was his previous coach before Ty? Malone, right? And it brought up...
Was Malone before Ty?
Yes.
I believe so.
I believe it was Mike Malone. And it brought up the dynamic of their relationship. And actually, the article went in depth to indicate that that was probably one of the best coaching-player relationships that he has had in the NBA. That
yeah,
he respect-
firing Mike Malone was one of the dumbest things the Kings have ever done. And that is saying something.
Yeah, because that article talked about the fact that he... DeMarcus actually respected Malone. Malone would call him out, but Malone was not afraid to call him out because he knew he could and because he knew that DeMarcus would respond, and he did. And it was a really interesting dynamic between the two of them. And you're right, it was a stupid mistake for Sacramento to get rid of him. And then the article then goes on to say it was a mistake for them to put it on Ty. Ty was the GOAT or the problem. You know, everything just kind of fell on him. GOAT is not the right word, but just... He got into problems. And then since then, it's never been the same. They brought in, you know, who'd they bring in? A Hall of Famer next. And it was a failure, an utter failure. And so it was just a very interesting article. I have to send you the link. You guys will have to read it. It's very long, but it's very good about who is wrong and who is right there. And John, I think I'm agreeing with you. DeMarcus is not gonna last as long as he's in Sacramento.
Okay, next quick hit.
Okay.
30 years ago today, a young man named Michael Jordan dunks from the free throw line.
Yep.
I wasn't alive to see it, so take me down memory lane, will you?
John, go for it.
I was alive to see replays. I didn't see it live. But I do remember that just like igniting, what's the word I want to say? Michael Jordan was the next chapter in the NBA with that moment. The NBA at then was Magic versus Bird. But when that happened, Michael Jordan became the third biggest guy in the NBA. And a year later, he would replace both of them as the number one guy.
To this day, Devin, I've still never seen a player fly like that. That was flying.
Not even me?
Not even close. I have never, in all of the attempts that players have tried to mimic that play, no one has ever done it as good as MJ. That was flying, literally.
Okay, well, you know, this guy pushed off, so let's talk about something else that happened. 23 years ago today, coincidentally, I believe that same man decided to hang up the sneakers and get some cleats. And signed a minor league deal with the Chicago White Sox. How big of a mistake was that for his basketball career, or was it not one?
I don't think it was.
Yeah, I don't think it was. And he's lucky he did it in the time before Twitter, because at the time, I never heard about his gambling issues until years later, many years later.
Yep.
And you just couldn't get away with that now.
I have a reason to believe why that wasn't a mistake for his career, because what happened his first year back, first full season back?
Well, they made the playoffs, and then the next year he won his championship.
His first full season back. Yeah, he came back half a season that year they made the playoffs. First full season back, 72-10. Was that good for his basketball career? Yeah, I think so. It was good for Pippen, too.
I'm just saying, you know, it makes you wonder what would have happened during that time.
Well, they would have been playing against the Rockets for two straight years. Would they have beat them? Probably. I don't know.
Probably. You know? That's what I always say is Hakeem's really lucky Michael Jordan was retired those 2 years.
I agree. But on the same token, I'll also say that I think Pippen benefited from Michael being away, because I think that that's why they were able to go 72-10.
See, but I think he probably should have taken off like 97, 98.
I agree.
Different years.
You're not getting a disagreement from any Jazz fan on that one.
Yeah.
All right.
He might have been better at baseball if he had done that too.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Probably. No, what a mistake. Okay. So the Falcons, Atlanta Falcons, let's jump to a little NFL here, added a new offensive coordinator. A man named Steve Sarkisian. The name seems familiar. Are you surprised that he would jump from Alabama to the NFL that quickly? How quickly he came back into coaching, coached one championship game, blew it, and then went to another championship team that had just blown it?
I am surprised, yes, a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of looks like he's falling upwards, but...
That's a good way of putting it.
Right place at the right time, I guess.
I'm more surprised that Quinn and the Falcons are willing to take a chance on him.
Yeah, it just seemed so odd to me. You know, that quick of a turnaround. But yeah, John, I think falling up is exactly what's happening there.
Agreed.
Let's talk about the Super Bowl. I don't want to talk about much of it. I just want to know, where does the Super Bowl rank in terms of the epic collapses that we've seen in championship games and or series this year? Because we've had the Warriors blowing a 3-1 lead. We had Cleveland, Indians. Didn't they blow a 3-1 lead?
Yes, they did.
3-1 lead.
Yes, they did.
You've got,
and then you had the Falcons blow a 21-3 lead.
Yeah.
It just seems that everyone is trying to outdo the last person in the worst way possible.
And then the Jazz beat the Hawks the night after by 25. Oh, anyway. No, it's, I hadn't thought of it as the meltdown that it was, but yeah, it was. But equally as good as that meltdown was the fact that the Patriots just looked so good, so different in the second half.
They did though. You're right there though. You're on like the 30-yard line. You've got like 6 minutes left. Run the ball a couple times, kick the field goal. Worst case scenario, well, Matty Ice, throw the ball away. Do not take the sack that takes you out of field goal range.
Here's the thing. Why aren't they running on every single play? I mean, the Falcons ran very few plays in the second half. And when you got a big lead, run.
And I can understand sticking to your offense because you thought that was going to happen. They got the ball. I think they were back around like the 5 and they threw an out pass and picked up like 40 yards just to start the drive off. And you were like, okay, go down, kick the field goal at least. And you know, you only have to move the ball 20 yards from there. And they had it. I mean, Julio made this amazing catch to get him in field goal range. And then they threw it away, but that's exactly what they didn't do. They take a sack, they go way back, and it's still a one possession game. I don't know. That's a pretty big collapse to blow a lead like that. Not just in a game, but they blew it in the second half because didn't they open up the second half by scoring a touchdown and opening the margin even more?
Yeah, they did.
Yeah.
But see, they started the second half going 3-and-out. The Patriots stopped them. And then the Patriots turned the ball over. And then you're right. Then they scored a touchdown to go up. And then you thought, okay, they're back in control. The Patriots don't have a chance. And then you're right. Then it went from there. You know,
Well, it was 21-3 at half. Didn't they actually get it 28-3 at one point?
Yeah, that's what we're talking about. Opening drive of the second half, so they went 3-and-out, but then they got a turnover back from the Patriots on the next drive, and then they scored immediately on the following drive.
Let's simplify this. What is worse, the Falcons in the Super Bowl or what the Warriors did in the finals?
I think the Falcons' collapse is worse. Because of the amount of time. I do because with the Warriors collapse, it's not really so much a collapse where they had them on the brink and they barely lost it. The Falcons were way ahead and they only had to play well for another 20 minutes and this is all over. And they let the Patriots come back and then they made mistakes. And then the Patriots come back more and they make mistakes. And you just watch the game slip away. The whole time they're probably thinking, well, we still got this. Well, we still got this. Well, we still got this. And yet they couldn't make those plays. And that some of the play calling, when it's first and 22, first and 10 on the 22, and you wind up getting yourself out of field goal range, that is a meltdown by your team.
Yeah, no, I see it. And Devin, you pose an interesting question because I saw this on Twitter and saw a few folks talking about it last night. And they posed the same discussion that we are here. And one of them mentioned that in the Warriors series, you have a day or two off to make adjustments. You have quarters and timeouts to make adjustments. Whereas in the game of football, you got that halftime to make your adjustments and that's all you got. The rest of the time it's on the fly if you're lucky.
Right, right. And the thing to consider, I see what John's saying, the other side of that coin is the Warriors had 3 chances.
Right.
To get it together.
Right.
You know, you can really screw up one day and then refocus and go out and you have another shot at it. But they really choked 3 times in a row, closing it out. And
right.
How many of those were at home? I can't even remember what the format is. Were 2
it
at
was,
home?
Yeah, they had the final 2 were at home. No, the final 1 was at home. No, well, 2 out
do,
of the final
they
3.
Do,
yeah.
They do 2-2-1-1-1 now.
Yeah, right. 2 of the final 3.
That's what
3.
I thought. Yeah. So they had 2 chances at home.
Right.
And 1 on the road.
Right.
So especially Atlanta came in hot, you know, and Atlanta's been solid. But the Warriors, once again, were the best regular season team of all time.
Right. And the Falcons weren't.
So it's, I don't know. They're both terrible, right? The only explanation that I heard that made any sense is that the Falcons did not want to go to the White House. That's the only thing. They were like, hey, we could win this. We've never won one of these. But here's what would have to happen. And they're like, you know what?
Final thoughts on this before we transition. I know this was your final quick hit. I have a couple of questions to ask of both of you. First of all, first time that it goes to overtime in the Super Bowl. But that aside, have you ever seen 3 of the more sensational, beautiful catches in any of football than you did 2 by Julio Jones and 1 by Edelman ever before like that? you know which catches I'm talking about.
Yeah, there's, I mean, there are few Super Bowls that have that one amazing catch. For me, it was really two. It was Julio Jones with that catch on the sideline where he was conscious enough to get that second toe tap in before he hit the ground.
Yeah.
And then Edelman with that, with just the presence of mind to be able to grab that ball inches off the ground so that it's a catch. Those are two I think I will remember for a long time.
I will say this, Edelman's catch, it was amazing, but I believe the ball wasn't on the defender's leg for a moment.
Yes.
Like
it was.
It's like, dude, get your leg out of the way and you're golden.
But what killed me was the way he gathered it. He got off the leg. He lifts it up, drops it almost, and then grabs it again, collects it.
Just like 2 inches off the ground.
So, you know, and John, back to your point, Jones had two of those. That was the better of the two, but go back earlier in the second quarter where he made another one of those sensational sideline toe tapping catches. I don't know if you remember that one. He caught it with his toes right on the sideline together and then fell out of bounds. Two catches by, I think, the best receiver in football right now. And just sensational catches. And then my final question, Tom Brady, GOAT or no?
Yeah.
Devin?
5 Super Bowls.
No.
No?
7 appearances.
No. He's got an asterisk next to his name. The scandals that have been there in New England, I will admit he is a phenomenal player and is one of the greats, and he could be the greatest of all time.
Okay.
But I'm not willing to give him that title without putting the asterisk next to it that says, you know what, that there's a little bit of shine taken off of this for you.
Even in a comeback where he didn't have his full health, his full team at full health? Really?
Really.
Okay. Fair enough.
I just can't do it. You know, that's like you talk about Barry Bonds, you know, and being this phenomenal home run hitter without looking at the other side of that. You know, there is the asterisk there. I'm sorry, there is.
All right. We could get into this a lot further another time. That's all I wanted. Okay. That's it for quick hits. Let's go to our final segment, pop culture.
I saw The Founder this week. Have you guys seen it?
I have not.
It stars Michael Keaton as Ray Kroc, which a lot of people believe is the founder of McDonald's. He actually isn't, but he managed to steal McDonald's. It was really fascinating to watch this story. Michael Keaton plays Ray Kroc, and he's this middle-aged salesman who's struggling to sell kitchen parts. And he comes across the McDonald's restaurant, and he's just amazed that these two brothers have put together this restaurant where they're able to serve food in 30 seconds, because back then it took 30 minutes. And he just falls in love with the place, and he wants to be a part of it, and he wants them to franchise. And he gets them all excited about his vision to franchise the company and spread it. And the longer he works for him and the more money he makes, the more he decides that he wants out of his contract. And what starts, the movie feels like it's going to be this really... this plucky tribute to capitalism, and this guy just who's just really determined and persistent and follows his dream and finds something and has a vision to make it bigger. But then as the movie keeps going, you realize this guy is actually kind of evil. I mean, he ultimately screws the McDonald's brothers out of their own restaurant that they started. And, you know, by the end, I mean, I admired it, but I came out of there just going, man, Ray Kroc's a jerk. So it was really fascinating because you have this protagonist that you like him and you're on his side and you want him to succeed and you see him following his dreams. And you know, everyone wants to see someone follow their dreams. But then by the end, you realize that, wait a minute, this was actually a satire of the dark side of capitalism and how this guy... You took these wholesome, good-hearted people who are the McDonald's brothers, and they wind up getting screwed out of their own company that with their name on it. And one of the Last Shots is their original restaurant. They were forced to change the name of their McDonald's restaurants because Ray Kroc wound up owning their name, and they wound up changing it to the Big M, and they went out of business because of the McDonald's across the street. And it was just kind of sad. And I was just like, oh my gosh, this guy is horrible. But I mean, Michael Keaton, there was talks he might get nominated for an Oscar. I would have been happy with him getting nominated for an Oscar. I honestly think it was probably a better performance than what Ryan Gosling did in La La Land, but you know, they missed out on it. I think the marketing missed their chance with this, but yeah, it was very interesting.
You know, I hadn't understood the full story before until you were explaining it just now, but it makes sense. See, Ray Kroc to me, sure, is synonymous with McDonald's, but I picture him as the beginner of the franchise, right? Because McDonald's, he pioneered the franchise like model. Mm-hmm. And you see every other fast food chain try and model it after the way he set up that whole franchise model and the production line and the way he did things. So that's what I'm picturing when it comes to McDonald's. Interesting that you tell this movie.
That's the thing. It was the brothers' production line. It was their vision on how to make a speedy food process. And,
gotcha.
And that's what's the thing is everyone, I mean, you ask them about McDonald's, and if they can think of anyone who came up with it, it was Ray Kroc, and it really wasn't. It was Ray Kroc who successfully managed to turn it into a franchise, but it was really the McDonald's brothers. And I feel bad for their family when you realize how much money they could have had if they hadn't let Ray Kroc screw them out of their contract.
So was this movie to tell the true story behind it, or do you think was it?
Well, it's just telling the interesting story of Ray Kroc, and it's kind of subversive the way it does it, because it's from John Lee Hancock, and he directed The Alamo, and I think he directed The Rookie. I think he directed The Blind Side too. Okay. So he's pretty good about doing these true life stories with who could be inspirational figures. And you get that feeling in the beginning. And then by the time you get to the end, you're like, wait a minute. This is like all the Kingsmen of fast food.
Oh gosh.
So I thought that was pretty interesting.
All right. So, yeah, well, The Founder, that's a movie I had intended to check out. You would say yes is a must-see then?
I wouldn't say must-see. I give it 3 stars.
Okay. All right.
I liked it. It's worth seeing.
Okay. All right. Well, I don't have anything to pose in pop culture. Devin, anything?
I don't have anything movie wise. I'm just curious. Did you guys enjoy the halftime show of the Super Bowl, or did you not watch it?
I did. I thought she did a good job. I think I have liked more of the halftime shows lately than not. I think the Black Eyed Peas was the nadir of halftime shows, and everything after that's been pretty good. So this one was good. You know, I would say Beyonce's was good. Katy Perry's was good. I think the Super Bowl's been smart about their halftime entertainment lately.
The drones were really good. I like the drones. I'm not a Lady Gaga fan. Sorry, I'm not the person to ask on this. I shut down for halftime. Wasn't interested. But did she do a good job? Yeah, it looked like she did, and I'm fine with it. The drones were great, though. I really liked the cool thing they did with those. But yeah, no big deal.
See, I don't know that I'd say I'm a fan. I think she's a very talented person. You know, she did go to like one of, if not the greatest music schools in the States. But I realized how many Lady Gaga songs I know.
Wow.
Because it kept transitioning. I'm like, yep, I know this one. Yep, I know this one.
Yeah.
I know all of them because my daughter.
I don't think you really have to be a fan to have enjoyed that show, though. I wouldn't say anyone in my family's a fan per se, but everyone agreed it was a really good halftime show. I think you can appreciate the performance.
I'm just waiting for Metallica to come and sing next year. So go ahead, give me the weird look. John, don't we want a Metallica halftime show?
Maybe. Okay. I happened to see Metallica in concert once and was underwhelmed, so maybe I'm the wrong guy to ask.
Okay, never mind. Yes.
Wow, that backfired. Why don't we wrap the show up, Alan?
All right, we'll wrap it up before I backfire on myself anymore here. Oh, all right. Thank you all for joining us for yet another edition of Jedi and Germs. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, you can find us on iTunes, Jedi and Germs. Please leave us a review. You can find us on Stitcher, blogtalkradio.com, and tornbysports.com, as well as Facebook and Twitter. Thank you all for listening. Look for us next week. John, take us out.
Bye, everybody.